Parliament shocked the country. The National Assembly of South African Parliament sent shockwaves throughout the country, setting in motion a process to change the constitution so as to allow expropriation of land without compensation. Now, there are people who say that's absolutely impossible because, as a London barrister, Malcolm Horn, commented, it is impossible to have land confiscation without compensation. It is illegal under international law. It is in violation of a dozen treaties that South Africa is signatory to and has ratified. It is a principle that is enshrined in South African domestic law. It's part of our Bill of Rights. And you cannot change a constitution, therefore you cannot make legal what is illegal. So this barrister in Britain, who's obviously British, he's not South African, he believes it's impossible. I've seen some people have said, oh, you know, Cyril Ramaphosa is really clever, this is brilliant, because there's no way this is going to succeed, because the Constitutional Court will throw it out, and then he will have, with one fell swoop, destroyed the support base of the EFF, and Julius Malema is going to be without any supporters, and the ANC stays in power, all the people rejoin him. Now, I think this is a bit of wishful thinking, but there are people who've got that view that, look, this is just a political ploy, this is a ploy for votes. Ramaphosa can say, well, you know, we tried, and the Constitutional Court threw it out, well, you know, what could we do? And but they're ignoring the huge amount of groundswell of expectations that are completely unrealistic and cannot be fulfilled. Now, there's all kinds of distortions in history, in the media, myths and legends and exaggerations in school textbooks, which have serious consequences. It's the lies about South Africa's history that has led to this position where people think that you can just confiscate land, which, of course, to them is a wonderful opportunity for looting. And I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. He laid hold of the dragon, the serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years, and he cast him at the bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal on him so that he should deceive the nations no more. So obviously nations are being deceived today. God is truth. God's word is truth. Jesus Christ is the way, the truth, and life. We are lost, and Jesus is the way. We are deceived, and Jesus is the truth. And we are dead in our trespass and sins, and Jesus is the life. And war broke out in heaven, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. There is a battle going on, and that's why we've got to keep our eyes wide open to understand the signs of the times, and we've got to keep our sword sharp. Satan is deceiving nations. We are being subject to the greatest flood of misinformation and disinformation in the history of mankind. Under the duties required in the Ninth Commandment, the Westminster Larger Catechism lists the duty of preserving and promoting the truth, the duty to stand for the truth and to do so from the heart, the duty to speak the truth and only the truth in matters of judgment and justice, the duty to speak the truth at all times, the duty to study and practice everything true, noble, lovely, and of good report. Under the sins forbidden, the Ninth Commandment Westminster Standards lists the sin of giving false evidence, the sin of lying, the sin of concealing the truth, the sin of misconstruing intentions, the sin of exaggerating, the sin of perverting the truth to wrong meaning, which is what Hollywood does on a regular basis with virtually every single one of their films, and certainly their awards. What are the lies that are enslaving us today and leading to this disaster that this government is trying to perpetrate in us right now? Lies, omissions, distortions are a hallmark of propaganda. Truth does not fear investigation, but facts can really ruin a good story. Jesus said, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." Now, you notice Zuma and Mugabe were shoulder to shoulder on a whole lot of things. Mugabe did his farm invasions. Zuma was talking about it. Zuma and Ramaphosa are pals. To suggest that somehow they're major competitors, well, Jacob Zuma made Cyril Ramaphosa his vice president. And Cyril Ramaphosa and Julius Malema and Winnie Mandela are totally together. They are pals, they are friends, they are comrades, they are compatriots. And this suggestion that Julius Malema is running an opposition to ANC, I think, is probably a deception operation. It sometimes happens that you present an apparent divided front for the purpose of confusing your enemy and also to being able to get support for the one and then the other. The Russians and Chinese played this game for decades. They pretended there was a split between Russia and China, which was probably a deception operation. There's a lot of evidence that it was. And they even staged a couple of apparent border clashes for this purpose. But what would happen is America would alternately build up China's military because Russia's the real threat, then build up Russia because China's the real threat, then build up China because Russia's the real threat, and build up, you know, and it's, they're both the enemies. They're both communists, as though Marxists would have more common cause with the capitalist West than with one another, who they might have some minor doctrinal issues with. Just like when push comes to shove, we as Christians should look past denominational differences and stand shoulder to shoulder against Islam, communism, or other threats to the faith. In the same way, Marxists, when you get down to it, they will stand with other Marxists. Julius Malema could well be playing a deception operation to make people think the ANC has been losing support and come back. As you saw, Julius Malema proposed in Parliament 2.5 weeks ago, the day I got on a plane to fly over to Australia. We couldn't exactly respond much quicker as an intensive program there. Julius Malema proposes this land appropriation or confiscation without compensation bill, and it's immediately adopted by all the votes of the ANC and the EFF. The EFF and ANC voted together in total unanimity on it. Only COPE, DA, Freedom Front, and ACDP voted against. All the ANC, all the EFF voted together. 241 in support, only 83 votes in objection. And this is, it's been described as imbecilic and racist, misleading our people for cheap popularity just to win votes. The notion of a stolen land is a false narrative. There is no stolen land. Well, except what the government stole. Cyril Ramaphosa, I might add, we've had dealings with before. Back in 1995, we led the march of 30,000 people to Parliament, clogged the whole of Cape Town, the biggest demonstration I'd seen in Cape Town to that date, and to protest the secularization of the country, the new constitution, and at Parliament, where apparently, according to Kenneth Meshew, who's inside, he said there was absolute panic. They thought that the days were up and we were going to storm Parliament and hang them from the nearest lamppost. Because, you know, if they'd had a protest that big, then they would probably have done that to their enemies. And they pushed Cyril Ramaphosa out the door, and he was pouring a sweat. I mean, I saw him. He looked absolutely terrified. And this was May. It's winter. It's cold. He was pouring a sweat. His eyes were wide. He was absolutely terrified. Kenneth Meshew said that he saw the ANC people literally pushed him out the door and shut the door of Parliament. He had to go out to receive our memorandum. And Cyril Ramaphosa, he arrives there and he looks around and he sees Reverend Finus Obisi of Christ of Intermission stand next to me, a Zulu brother. And he is holding a nice big black leather bound Bible with gilt edge and thumb index. And he said, "Brother, can I borrow your Bible?" And without waiting for a response, he grabbed his Bible and went up the stairs onto the platform, which was on the back of a truck that we were using as our platform outside Parliament. And he goes up the microphone, he lifts the Bible above his head, said, "I am also a Christian. Look, I bring my Bible to Parliament with me every day." You know, slick, smooth-talking, charismatic in many of his ways. He had the crowd cheering and applauding him in just a few minutes. And but Fano and I looked at one another in absolute shock. You know, we knew politicians lied, but boy, so blatantly. Wow. This man is a smooth talker. Now, what the government's doing with this land reform thing is it's a carrot and a stick business. So the poor populace who are expected to do this land reform, they've been given this carrot, which is like diseased and dead. And they don't have a chance. I mean, land reforms historically have been a total catastrophe. If you haven't seen the film Bitter Harvest of the Ukrainian Holodomor, when the Russians killed between 6 to 11 million people by sheer starvation, looting, destroying, burning crops, taking over everything. This radical land reform of Stalin, absolute catastrophe in the 1930s. And that's the way it worked. That was called dekulakization. Of course, Zimbabwe tried it too. Now, yes, okay. Julius Malema's EFF, you know what EFF stands for? The Everything for Free Party. And he thinks by kicking white South Africans in the back, it's going to bring about prosperity. But of course, it's a very fine balance to bring about prosperity in any country. It takes a lot of hard work, a lot of sacrifice and ingenuity. If we've eaten today, thank a farmer and the farm workers. No farmer, no food, no future. No farmer, no food, no future. That's a fact. And there are some people who are making a stand saying, this is our land, back off government, which is brave. There are people standing up like this Uhuru Club saying, taking from whites is not a crime in South Africa. Stealing is not a crime. In fact, I've heard of pastors preaching this in Khayelitsha saying, stealing from white folks, that's not a sin. God will say, well done, good and faithful servant. You just go steal as much as you want. Killing white folks, that's not a sin. Kill as many as you want. God will say, well done, good and faithful servant. That's been preached from some pulpits in our city. South Africa is the only country in the world that we know of where 90% of the taxpayers didn't vote for the ruling party. We've got a 1.9 million taxpayer base in this country, and most of them didn't vote for the ANC. So you've got 50 million people being funded by less than 2 million taxpayers. However, Cyril Ramaphosa, who opened this can of worms in the very same night that Christians were saying all over the place, we're saved, it's a new day, praise God, God's answered our prayers, you know, Zuma's gone, this is the answer of prayers, our Cyril Ramaphosa is going to save the country. In that very first speech, that very first night, Sona, State of the Nation address, he spoke about land confiscation without compensation, and he got the longest and most sustained applause of the night for that statement. Is he playing a deceptive game? Is he doing this in order to prove that you can't do it because the Constitutional Court's going to overwhelm it? I don't think you can unleash these forces and then put them back in the bag easily. He says, however, oh, but no one's got the right to invade land when they started doing that the very next week. This is a clear sign of disorder. Well, EFF's organizing it. And he, along with others in the parliament, voted for the bill that Julius Malema had proposed. Those who occupy land without permission will face the full might of the law. I'd like to see that happen. I'd like to see them prosecute that. Now, you know who Dr. Ambrosini was? Dr. Ambrosini was an Inkatha Freedom Party advocate, a lawyer. He's dead now. But in his biography, he writes, in his brutal honesty, Ramaphosa told me of the ANC's 25-year strategy to deal with the whites. Now, Ambrosini died several years ago. So he didn't know that Cyril Ramaphosa was going to become next president at that stage. So Cyril Ramaphosa said to Ambrosini, and this is in Ambrosini's book, his biography, it would be like boiling a frog alive, which is done by raising the temperature very slowly. Being cold-blooded, the frog does not notice the low temperature, slow temperature increase. But if the temperature is raised suddenly, the frog will jump out of the water. He meant the black majority will pass laws transferring wealth, land, and economic power from white to black slowly and incrementally until the whites lost all they gained in South Africa, but without taking too much from them at any given time to cause them to rebel or fight. Now, Ambrosini is somebody that I knew. He stood for quite a few things, like he was part of our anti-canned lion hunting march and against rhino poaching, and he was known as an Inkatha Freedom Party member of parliament who was concerned for a whole range of issues. And interesting, This is, of course, Cyril Rinpoche standing next to Mandela and de Klerk and Ralph Mayer. And, of course, it was Cyril Rinpoche standing right next to Mandela at the inauguration because he was the chairman of their Constitutional Assembly, which drafted the present constitution, which entrenches private ownership of property and that you cannot have land taken without compensation and things like that. So what's he doing? Do you know that the Southern government is sitting on over 4,323 farms which were handed over by their previous white owners but were never transferred to any black owners or any other owners and are sitting doing nothing? In fact, the government owns more land than all the farmers they're talking about, but they don't tell you that. In fact, they give very misleading statistics. For example, they say something like 80% of all the farmland, of the best farmland, is in the hands of these white commercial farmers. Well, it's because they turned the wilderness into productive farms. It's not because these farms are waiting for them, you know, they got off the ship, Dromedaris and Table Bay, and, you know, they walked up there and there was Fort Constantia and there was Franschhoek, and they just settled into the homes and sat in their stoop drinking rooibos and eating cook sisters while their farm was producing harvest. They had to hack it out of the wilderness. There was nothing there. There's thorn bushes, elephants, hippos, tigers, I mean lions. We've got a place called Tigerberg, and Radio Tigerberg has tested the fact that some people didn't know the difference between a leopard and a tiger. We know there weren't tigers here, but we do have a place called Tigerberg, just to remind us. Some people's animal recognition was deficient. But here we've got a government that's already, in this case, not confiscated, but bought farms from farmers, which they haven't handed over to anyone doing anything. And that's not speaking about the failures. Your city on socialism tends to look like this. Your hospital on socialism tends to look like this. Your grocery store on socialism would look like this. Think Zimbabwe. But your politician socialism, he lives like that. So socialism, okay, it impoverishes most people. Boy, it's great for enriching the politicians. If you haven't read Animal Farm, you're about to see it carried out. If they go ahead with this farm redistribution, it's exactly what George Orwell observed in the Soviet Union when he went to visit in the 1930s under Joseph Stalin. He saw it during the Ukrainian dekulakization land reform program. And he writes Animal Farm inspired by the land reform policies of Stalin in Russia, which is obviously the model for what Mugabe just did in Zimbabwe. All animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. Imagine a world without organized atheism. I mean, we have had communism tried on over 40 different occasions, and every single time there have been a total, complete, catastrophic disaster with no redeeming features whatsoever. Everywhere from Cambodia, killing fields, Vietnam, North Korea, Red China, think Great Cultural Revolution. Bear in mind that the Great Cultural Revolution came about 20 years after the communists seized China. There's always a two-phase to the revolution. What I'm concerned about is that what we're about to see is the second phase of the revolution. You see, Mugabe got Zimbabwe in 1980, and only in the year 2000 did they start their second phase of taking the farms. Similarly with China, Mao Zedong consolidated his control in 1968, 20 years after they'd taken China. He mobilized the young Red Guards, who were too young to have known what life was like under nationalist China, and they could therefore believe the lies and propaganda of the communists. And they went out and they destroyed thousands of years of Chinese heritage and culture. And China had been built on respect for the aged, but he had brought up a new generation with no respect for the aged, and they just trampled on everything. And that was the great leap forward, the Cultural Revolution, 1968. Land reform in Zimbabwe has been a total and complete catastrophe, economic suicide. You're talking about, when they talk about land reform, don't think of a productive commercial white farmer being replaced by a productive commercial black farmer. What it is just looting. It's looting. These aren't people going in there because they would like to farm. They're not interested in farming. They're just interested in attacking, beating up, pillaging. In this case, you've got this farmer in Zimbabwe near Bulawayo. His wife had polio and he had two daughters. He sent them into town knowing that something bad's going to come their way. They were talking about land reform. This farmer fought for 3 hours against 100 North Korean-trained 5th Brigade with full AK-47 kits and all, and he had a bolt-action rifle and a shotgun. He kept 100 men at bay, killed at least 18 of them, and only stopped when he ran out of bullets. And in the end, he was in the bathroom. They burned the house down. He was using the water as much as he could to stop the fire. In the end, he had to climb out to get away from the smoke, and then they beat him to death. During this time, farmers from Iran came to his support, but there were police roadblocks preventing him getting in. But his death was not in vain, because that was the first and last time that the Zimbabweans tried attacking a farm, because he fought. And after that, they tried every other means to get the farmers off, because they knew they're not going to go for a head-to-head confrontation. 100 North Korean 5th Brigade, which was their elite, couldn't take out one farmer until he ran out of bullets. Okay, so here you've got an example of land reform in Zimbabwe. On the left, evil colonial, on the right, liberated, better, as you can see. Pre-revolution, post-revolution. The way the farm used to be in the sort of Rhodesian days, how it looked now under Zimbabwe. And so it is. And so you can go through it. This is land reform in Zimbabwe, a total, complete, utter catastrophe. It was an economic catastrophe along the lines of a national suicide, because what they did in Zimbabwe is they went from being a food exporting country to being a country where most of the food had to be imported. And then more than half of the total population of Zimbabwe had to flee the country. Literally, what other country can you think of that's had more than half the population leave, vote with their feet? Zimbabwe went from being one of the greatest agricultural economies in Africa down to being an absolute disastrous basket case. The only independent non-government controlled newspaper blown up while the police stood at distance laughing. And this is Liberation Zimbabwe. Boot on the neck, being whipped by police and battle gear. This in the old Jamison Avenue, which now is called Samora Machel Avenue. You have been liberated and freed. That's why you get beaten up. The people in Ethiopia managed to topple their communist masters, and they toppled the idol of Lenin on the way outside of Addis Ababa. And this is where Mugabe and all the thugs of the past are heading, for the dustbin of history. Communism never works. But now in South Africa, we've got a land reform policy, so-called, where they are looking at covetously at land that's now very effective, and they've got an idea of restoring dignity to the land, really. And, yep, progress. Lots of ideas, but, you know, it doesn't last, and it doesn't matter how many hundreds of millions, in fact now billions of rands, been put into these redistributed farms. They just become, yes, I mean, nothing, and then for sale. Did you receive compensation? Yes. Did it help? Not at all. Almost everyone. Only partially. Nobody says it really helped. So the compensations that they speak about for the farmers once they've taken their lands, not really good. So then you get a successful land claimant. And, yeah, all these farms, every single one the government set up, they got it all free, working excellent farms, whether it's dairy farms, whether it was pineapple farms, none of them working. But land, food, jobs. Wasn't that Mandela's slogan in 1994 elections? Yes, it was also Lenin's slogan in 1917. Of course, they promise all sorts of things that just don't deliver it. Land or death. This is the black land first, is it? Those characters, that's one of their slogans. Land or death. Okay, so it might be all wrecked and it's, you know, can you give me some food? There's South Africa asking for food. No, but at least the land is mine. This is the point. Land reform is primarily about greed, envy, hatred, destruction, and it's not so much having something as much as making sure you don't have it. And socialism is the creed of envy. It's the national religion of hell. And since the process of so-called land reform has begun in South Africa, 1994, 75% of agricultural productive land returned to beneficiaries has been allowed to fall into disuse. That's a nice way of putting it. But consider the fact that there used to be hundreds of thousands of farm workers and their family members and dependents benefiting from those farms when they're operational. And since they've become unoperational, in Zimbabwe, millions of people have been affected who were either work on the farms or were relatives or dependents of those work on the farms, who now have no homes, no work, nothing, and no food. They've had to pour into cities, live in shacks, or fled across the border, living in other shanties, where they used to have a wonderful life on these very productive farms that were exporting food, producing most of the foreign exchange, most of the exports, most of the earnings. The biggest employers in Zimbabwe are now total disaster, and Mugabe is putting this as his success story, and our dear friend Julius Malema, Juju, thinks that Mugabe is a wonderful example. Now, there's other victims that you may not know about, like these 400,000 white people who've been dispossessed of land and who have no employment because of black economic empowerment, affirmative action, and you're not allowed to give donations to them. It doesn't. Whites don't get donations. They may not get electricity. They don't get the water. They don't get any of the help that you'd get if you're in Khayelitsha or in any of the other areas, whether it's Crossroads or so on. So there's a whole generation growing up who, you know, how can you blame them for whatever apartheid there was, which was voted out of office in 1983 and totally ended officially in 94, but in fact it hadn't been practiced for a long time before. And that's just the ones who've been dispossessed. But then there's the farmers who've been murdered and their family members. Officially, farmers are being murdered at a rate of 220 per 100,000. The general public in South Africa, 38 per 100,000 a year. Worldwide, 9 per 100,000. Places like England and Norway, less than 1 per 100,000 a year. Police in this country, which is terrible, 55 per 100,000 per year, which means a farmer has a 4 times higher risk, 4 times more dangerous profession than the police in our country. That makes the police in this country, the farmers in this country have a higher death rate than it's 700% worse than any other farmers in the world. That's pretty bad. Now, what do you see on social media? ANC councillor has killed the Boer killer farmer on his post. Here's another dear character. Gauteng Arts and Culture Department, Valefi Kumalo. I want to cleanse this country of all white people. Wow. And here you've got this other character from Anglo-American. White South Africans, your time is up. In the near future, you will pray and wish you were black. Your time is up. Pack up and go, suffer the consequences. God is not on your side. The Bible you brought is working against you. Blacks are awake, you better note that. Okay, then you get some other clever things like Julius Malema, which is so disgusting. And, you know, we need to rape whites. We need to murder them and torture them and burn them and burn their kids. And absolutely sadistic stuff from Julius Malema there. This person says he hates white people. Just get me a bazooka or AK-47 so I can do the right thing and kill these demon-possessed humans. Dehumanizing your victims is one of the steps towards genocide. And here you can see others, you know. This is the last year for all whites, and I mean all whites, and so on and so forth. And, you know, I celebrate with a big smile and dance while white farmers are killed here in the Free State. Our farm killers should keep killing farmers and, if possible, raping their women and little daughters and possibly infecting them with AIDS. Is that hate speech? No, that's not hate speech. Somebody complaining about overcrowded beaches where she got mugged, state agent. I mean, that person's got to go to jail, according to the government. That's hate speech. And then you've got all these affirmative action, black economic empowerment, which is apparently Zimbabwe and South Africa are the only countries on the planet where affirmative action is for the majority against the minority. Everywhere in the world that you have affirmative action, I don't think it's a good idea to have affirmative action anyway, it's for the minorities, to protect minorities from the majority. This is the only place in the world we get it to give advantage to the majority and to discriminate against the minority. A bit strange. One settler, one bullet. I used my guns to rob and kill Indians and whites. Please, fellas, join me. We have to rape the kids with AIDS virus too. Social media. But don't worry, it's not hate speech. Kill whitey, also not hate speech. In fact, old Julius Malema said, we are, just a week ago, we need to cut the throats of white males. The latest bit of nonsense from 12th of March this year, I am the Messiah of our time. I will give free land to my people. Unlike Jesus or Nelson Mandela and his friends, I don't need to go to a stupid prison to save my people, says Julius Malema. Well, he obviously doesn't fear God. According to a New Zealand newspaper, South Africans are killed at a rate of war. And that's extraordinary. We are capturing some of the people who do the murders. When they catch people involved in the farm attacks, in many cases they've got to let them go because they find out they're part of the South African National Defence Force or the South African Police Service, or they are part of the NIS, National Intelligence Service. In quite a few cases, I've heard fire brigade people say the same thing when arson was caused around the Cape, that in fact it's often National Intelligence Service people. Back with our worst fires that we had in 2000, that was overwhelmingly NIS. Fire brigade people said, no doubt, all of these fires, all the way through, including Knysna, were arson. And the kind of attacks that you get on CCTV, and in this case, these are police beating up a white mechanic in a mechanical workshop. Kate Hopkins, who's a British television producer, liberals, I appreciate you're willing to turn a blind eye to the slaughter of whites because they're the wrong color. But look, her dogs were stabbed to death. That's quite disgusting. This is an 87-year-old woman at a farm near Stellenbosch, Susan Joubert, attacked by three suspects, and her dogs were also killed. Yeah. And then all these sort of things with whites, it's not right. Propagation of whites is propagation of hatred, oppression, homophobia, sexism, transphobia, racism, and ableism. Have you ever heard of transphobia before? What is transphobia? What's ableism? For goodness sakes. Many years ago, this book came out, The Great South African Land Scandal. I think this is over 10 years old at least. But this book first started to show the scandal of the farms that had been taken by the government, of course for some compensation, always below what it should have been, but nevertheless they got something, how they'd been run into rack and ruin. The people who come from the cities are not interested in becoming farmers. They don't want to get up with the chickens, milk the cows, plow the land. They don't. All they want to do is loot what's there and destroy the rest and go back to the city slums where they were living. That's it. I mean, it's just, when they talk about land reform, understand that the EFF, the Everything for Free Party, is only thinking about looting. Not working. I mean, working. Huh? No. I mean, they'd rather sit and watch DSTV in some shack in Soweto. Okay, is this funny? Kill the Boer, kill the farmer. They've been singing it. The president's been singing it. Julius Malema's been singing it. The Constitutional Court said it's hate speech, but they're still doing it. Okay, I'm going to show just a few pictures recently of some people who survived farm attacks. These people survived. This is very recent. I'm not going to show ugly pictures, but these are just some pictures to put a face to the victims. These are the people who have been killed by farm murders. Well, we're talking about 4,000 white South Africans murdered, in many cases tortured to death in hideous ways. All of these people showing here are the faces of people who were murdered by these farm attackers. And it's important to have a face, and there are books out like Land of Sorrow, which give details of the people, the dates, the names, the places of those who've been murdered by these farmers. Now, this is the most disturbing picture of all to me, because this little girl in here was killed This is her bed. This is her backpack. This is her picture, and that's her blood. I mean, there's worse pictures to show, but that just... This depicts the savagery of what you do. Why would you need to kill her? What possible threat could she be? This is hatred. And so the farm murders, there's people left behind. There's people traumatized. There's a whole community traumatized. Land of Sorrow just takes the first 20 years till 2014, from 1994 to 2014, about the targeting and murders of the farmers. They even had to put a 18 age restriction on this book. Well, the picture, the book doesn't have pictures. It's just got details. Details, the words are enough. Up in the Transvaal, they have got this Plaas Moorder memorial as a protest. Started on the side of the N1, and it just keeps growing because the victims keep growing. When Member of Parliament Peter Krinnevold of the Freedom Front stood up in Parliament and addressed Jacob Zuma, said, "Are you aware that the victims are being strangled, burned with boiling water, burned with irons, tortured, dragged behind vehicles?" And he gave these sort of things. There was general laughter and jeering from the ANC and EFF benches, and one of them shouted out very clearly, "Bury them alive." And that's reported in this Australian news here. Bury them alive. Now, between 1994 and 2013, in South Africa, there were 625,000 people murdered. That's not counting the babies aborted. That's just talking about people outside the womb who were murdered. Of which, they worked out so many were culpable homicides and so many were murders. Okay, so maybe it was only 328,000 murders and others were maybe self-defense, perhaps. The Genocide Project has pointed out that of those, up till 2013, 68,000 were white South Africans murdered. Of those, 3,000 plus were farmers and their family members. So, to get an idea, under apartheid, of course, Hendrik Voigt didn't live till 1989, but anyway, in the 41 years of apartheid, of which Hendrik Voigt's a symbol, 7,000 people were murdered. In 41 years of war. In the 20 years since Mandela became president, so 2014, 682,000 murdered. An average of 25,000 a year. Mandela averaged 25,000 murders a year while he was president. So, roughly, in fact, in Favut's day, it was more like 60 murders a year while Favut was prime minister. But if you take an average from 1948 to 1989, that's why we had a war. We had 170 murders a year on average, they say. This statistics come from the South African Race Relations Institute. And yet Mandela has a monstrous idol set up for him. This is like, I'm going to give you land this big. Okay, what is genocide? To say that you want to destroy people and then to work towards it and to wipe them out as a people, or to attack their historic monuments or their language or their culture or their religious institutions, any of those constitutes genocide by dictionary definition. And we have people maliciously attacking and destroying all kinds of things, monuments, statues, all kinds of things that are important. And there are those of the Genocide Watch that have already been rating South Africa's on level 6 or 7 of the 8 stages of genocide. There's been a genocide complaint against the African National Congress, the party, and the government of South Africa lodged by Paul Kruger in 2011 already at The Hague, at the International Criminal Court. It's still to come to. We're in the queue. There's an Afrikaner Genocide Museum on the web where they are calculating, as of recently, over 4,000 white farmers and their family members murdered, 68,000 Afrikaners in general murdered. I believe that the statistic of that is inadequate. I believe it's more like 85,000. But they might be just taking Afrikaners, and that would explain the differentiation. This is in the Palace of Justice in Lausanne, in Switzerland. It shows Lady Justice without a blindfold, with her scales weighing the evidence, a sword of justice pointed down to an open Bible, and the elders of the city looking to Lady Justice. The title above says, Justice Lifts the Nations. And so the people have got all kinds of arguments and, you know, land reform, whatever it might be, but all decisions must be determined in accordance with the word of God, the law of God. How can there be justice if the justice system is being run by criminals? And here you can see some of our ANC officials in Parliament and the police who are sworn to protect us on duty. This, by the way, is a captain. Yeah. So, the world will not be destroyed by those who do evil, says Albert Einstein, but by those who watch them without doing anything. This is just in a month in last year, beginning of last year. So, January, February last year. And it's the ages of the people and how they were murdered. And you can put this for almost any month of the year. Now, apparently the various statistics on farm murders, and it's confusing people because it's designed to confuse people. The police stopped giving statistics on this back in 2001 under orders of Thabo Mbeki, present time. So we don't have statistics on the police. So the only way we can work out statistics, and Emma's been struggling over the last couple of weeks to pull these things together, we're looking at Transvaal Agricultural Union. They've got statistics on their people in the Transvaal Agricultural Union. So that's not the whole country. We've got the South African Institute of Race Relations. They've got what they know. There's AfriForum. They've got probably the most complete stats of all. The people who brought out this book, they did a massive amount of research to get this. But there's things we don't know because we don't have the resource that the police have. And so you've got statistics that are inadequate. But part of the goal of creating confusion about the numbers is to create a cognitive dissonance in the minds of people, a doubt, to direct them away from the truth. It's a trick normally masterfully played by stage magicians all over the world. Now, you'll recall Joseph Stalin said, the death of one person is a tragedy, but the death of a million is just a statistic. And that's one of the great dangers, that we think of it just in numbers. And here's another game they keep playing in this country since Mbeki, where they will say how the situation has improved from last year. You know, murders are 0.6% down from last year, or they're up 1.3% from... Yes, but if you compare it with what it was like 30 years ago, it's like, whoa, it's thousands of percent up. And we know that because we had Rob McCafferty do the Getting Away with Murder study. He did his master's in education. He did a academic analysis of the stats, and he compared with back to the 1930s and 1940s, 30s, 60s, all the way up. And I mean, that's really mean, because now you're showing a phenomenal contrast. Bear in mind that South Africa in 1970s and 80s, we were fighting a war and we had terrorism and riots, and yet we still had less people dying in the war than we have now dying in peace. But okay, here's some of the stats. So, 2017, 463 farm attacks. It's 1.3 farm attacks a day on average. 94 farm murders. Notice, most farm attacks fail. Some farm attacks kill more than one person, of course. So here you've got showing how many. There were 28 of these farm attacks in the Cape, and there were 18 in the Eastern Cape and 44 in the Free State and so on. So you're getting a bit of an idea. The people in black is farm attacks. The people in red are deaths, farm murders. So this gives you a bit of an idea. Also, they found out that the day of the week that you get the most amount of farm murders is a Thursday. How interesting. Average number of attackers, 3 in a mob. The most attackers in an attack, 12. Okay, now this is interesting. Here you see town attacks in black and town murders in red. So this gives you an idea. Of course, you'd expect in a town to have more murders because there's more people. Big question, is the war on farmers state-sponsored terrorism? I believe it is, without a doubt. A picture from a CCTV camera just before Farm Attack noted the military jammer on the back of these people, blocking all cell phone signals up to 500 meters. How can the government say they're not involved in farm attacks? Where do these farm attackers get cell phone jammers from? And here's a picture of farm attackers moving in. Notice the weapons in hand. And this is as they're preparing to come into a farm. Terrorist attacks in France, killing 127 people, and the whole world is in mourning and shock and putting French flags on their profile pictures. Terrorist attacks in France, South Africa, killing 4,000 people. Not a word. Northern Ireland, 1,000 people died in the 30 or 40 years of the war in Northern Ireland. 1,000. Everyone is traumatized by what's happened in Northern Ireland. 34 farmers were murdered in Kenya by the Mau Mau. 34. And the whole world knew about Uhuru and that. They've killed about that many so far this year, haven't they? Staggering. In East London, this farm couple were being repeatedly harassed in driveway by three black uniformed traffic cops. The man was whipped and assaulted the first time. The wife went along to video the cops who were frequently posting in their driveway, and then she reported this on the Buffalo City Crime Spotters Facebook page, that the three policemen were in the driveway again. When she tried to film them with a cell phone, they became aggressive and tried to arrest her. Now, we've had stories of policemen saying, you know, we're going to kill you all and things like this at traffic stops. So, this gives you a bit of an idea. Now we're up to January to February 2018. This is the last 2 months. 102 farm attacks, 12 farm murders. That's around South Africa here. This is speaking about oldest victim, 87 years old. Average number of attackers, 3, most attacks involved, 11. So this is again, main day they're attacking, Thursday again. And again, it's got the day, the night, and you've got most of the attacks at night, of course, as you'd expect, 46%. Less during the day, but still, this gives you a bit of an idea. And just today, Tulbagh, that's not far away. Another farm murder. Now, you know where NWU is? Northwest University, the old Potchefstroom, University of Christian Higher Education, now called Northwest. Kill the Boer, kill the racist, kill Afrikaans. Spot the oxymoron logical inconsistency in this series of statements. Feel it, it's war. Honeymoon is over for white people in South Africa. I didn't know there was one. I missed it. Yeah. The most racist people are the ones crying racist all the time. I mean, it's not surprising. The moment a person is racist. I mean, as he's saying, Army, watch it when you point a finger at somebody. There's three fingers pointing back at you. And in their case, maybe more. So South Africa is the failed land of the communist ANC. And this is the whole point. What you have to do, if you are picking somebody's pocket, you've got to distract them. If you're looting an entire country, you need a lot of distraction. And the ANC have been looting this country of so many things, and so they need a lot of distraction. And they've been playing the race card and the apartheid card and the land invasion card and fees must fall and roads must fall and Van Riebeek, anyone? Let's get everything to fall while they distract the people, and then they're looting and looting and looting more. This is all distraction. And if people can fall for this, they're really foolish. So there's a few blatant lies being told about South Africa's history. One, the uproar is over a claim by the ANC that the 1913 Land Act, which by the way was brought in by the British, but anyway, let's not worry about that, dispossessed blacks. But it's a blatant lie. It forms part of the core lies about South African history, which is driving this. The number one lie is that the Native Lands Act of 1913 shoved blacks on reserves onto just 7% of the land and prohibited them from buying land in white areas. Okay, the whites forcibly removed blacks to these reserves, and these reserves were on the worst land in the country with no mineral riches, and the whites kept all the best land and all the best minerals for themselves. That is part of the narrative that you hear ad nauseum. Now, if I was a black man, I'd probably also want to believe the myth, because that gives me eternal victimhood status and compensation for generations to come without having to do anything. But it's a blatant lie, and it can be attributed to lack of reading ability or legal comprehension of the journalists and historians of our time. First of all, the biggest platinum reserves in the world ran through the former black homeland of Bophuthatswana. Bophuthatswana had most of the platinum reserves, and yet the former nationalist government had no problem allocating this mineral-rich area to the Tswana tribes for self-rule, although the Tswanas already had a massive country called Botswana. Massive country, given to them already by the British. Now, bearing in mind that Botswana, Lesotho, and Swaziland were part of South Africa too, why are they not counted as part of the 7%? It was originally part of South Africa called Bechuanaland, and black South Africans further got another two massive countries from the British called Lesotho and Swaziland. So what's the 7% business? And for that matter, I mean, Swaziland, Lesotho, Botswana, those were all administratively part of South Africa at one time. Line number two, black homelands were put on the worst land in South Africa. Well, if you've driven through places like Transkei, Venda, Ciskei, you'll know that that's a total lie. When you compare the rainfall map of South Africa, and anyone with elementary knowledge of South Africa will tell you, the largest part of South Africa is called the Karoo, semi-desert. To drive from Cape Town to Joburg, which I've done who knows how many times, you go through vast amounts of territory where it's just like arid, you know, a few millimeters of rainfall a year, if you're lucky. It's a semi-desert, comparable to Arizona or Nevada. Black people never entered this area, let alone settled it. Whites made the desert blossom and created a few successful sheep farms producing meat of world quality through some very hard work. Digging of, I mean, this is most of the Cape, and that's, you know, this was given to the whites, and the best rainfall areas are given Transkei, Lesotho, Zululand, of course, and of course Venda, and so on. So they got most of the best rainfall area. The east coast has a subtropical climate, and the north is a prairie-like climate with summer rainfall, thunderstorms. An exception is the Western Cape with a Mediterranean climate and a winter rainfall. But generally speaking, the homelands got the best part of the land. In fact, Ulla Stegen has said, you give me any land in KwaZulu and I'll trade you any land in Natal. And he says, I'll make more productive farm out of any farmland in Zululand than you could ever make out of the farms that the whites have been given in Natal. So, no, that is not true. The northern eastern part of South Africa with its beautiful green grasslands and fertile soil is where blacks eventually coalesced, and this is the land they chose for themselves. They weren't moved off white land into black areas. They were moving in as immigrants coming from the north. The eventual homelands were found on land they inhabited out of their own free will. Nobody forced the Zulus to live in Zululand. That's just their chosen territory. The Afrikaners even have a song praising the greenness of Natal. Groen is die land van Natal. Green is the land of Natal. Perfect grazing area for cattle herding tribes like the Zulu. Line number three. Blacks are indigenous South Africa and they first settled it. Well, the problem is, no black person considers the Bushmen and the Hottentots to be black. They hunted them like animals. Today, blacks often tell Afrikaners and other minorities like coloureds, Indians, Chinese or Jews, adapt to the misrule and corruption or go home. Implying that we who've been born here, who hold legal citizenship through successive birthrights, we should immigrate to Europe or Malaysia, India or Israel because we don't belong here. But someone who arrived from Angola yesterday, he's indigenous, and someone like me who's born in Cape Town is an expatriate. The only ones who've got a legal claim to South Africa, all of it, are the blacks. And blacks believe they're indigenous to South Africa, but they're not. It's proven by DNA research, we all settlers in South Africa. Everyone came here. Even the Bushmen and the Hottentots moved here. Nobody was here from the inception. The white tribe of Africa gave up everything and fled Europe for religious freedom, civilized the savage, inhospitable land, like Olifantshoek, which now is called Franschhoek, into a first world nation where we did the first heart transplant, did the first lung transplant, the first successful C-sections, produced some of the most phenomenal equipment in the world, even in terms of military, gave up a country four times for the sake of peace, voted for a party that promised to extend anti-white laws, and calling them racists, expose a black supremacist agenda. So, Zulus stole other blacks' land and drove others off their land. And so, here's a person who was claiming that we should deal with the Zulus and so on. But everyone migrated from either the north or from the across the seas. Everyone is a settler in South Africa if you want to move far enough back. Proverbs 11:1, the Lord abhors dishonest scales, but accurate weights are his delight. I remember this. You could buy more with this 100 rand note when I was growing up than a 500 rand note could buy today if we had a 500 rand note. Okay, two 200 rand notes and a 100 rand note. This bought more than 500 rand can buy today. You could do a lot with 1 rand. I mean, with 50 cents pocket money, I could go to the cinema. I could get chips, popcorn, which is, you know, only 3 cents and 5 cents, and then still get an FX model aeroplane, Spitfire, Messerschmitt, and put together, and even the paint to paint it with, for 50 cents. Now, that economist, Stephen Mitford Goodson, says, prices don't go up. Money gets debased. Money gets devalued. He said, 2,000 years ago in Rome, if you wanted to buy a toga, which was a good outfit for a leader, with leather sandals and a leather belt, it would cost you a gold coin. He says today a suit and tie, belt and shoes will cost you a gold coin. The prices haven't changed. Money's been debased. That's an important thing to know. A survey of inflation in South Africa undertaken by the Old Mutual reported in 1971 you could buy a car for 1,000 rand. And I remember my dad in 1971 actually bought a car, a Valiant actually. 1981, the same amount of money could buy a motorbike, says Old Mutual. And in fact, in 1981, when I came out the army, I bought my first motorbike for 1,000 rand. Very nice bike too. Drove all the way to Mozambique with it a few times. But 2001, the buying power of 1,000 rand collapsed, so you could only buy a bicycle. And I remember buying a bicycle for 1,000 rand to go into Sudan with. Now, I'm told by my son, a good pair of running shoes could cost you well over 2,000 rand. So, when you think about theft, forget about the theft of what you think Jan van Riebeeck-Assen did, even though he didn't stay here long, and he died out in the Far East, but that's not the point. When you think about theft, the biggest theft on earth is being done by inflation and corruption and taxation. Now, the people who are doing the corruption, the taxation, and the inflation are the ones who are telling you we need restitution for theft. Well, I would love restitution for theft from them and the banksters who are behind them, actually. Skimping the measure, boosting the price, cheating with dishonest scales, I will never forgive, says the Lord. Amos 8:5-7. The devastating impact of unbacked currency and inflation on pensions and savings is criminal. We have got people in this country who worked hard, who saved well, who paid their taxes, who today have had to sell their home that they owned, move into a hovel because they can't afford to pay the rates and taxes on their house. People who should have retired at 60 or 65, working into their 80s, because their pensions are no good, and because the money is worth nothing, and their savings have been employed. This is theft on the worst level. This is stealing from widows and orphans. And yes, $100 trillion. And that's after they've knocked 16 zeros off already, and that couldn't buy a quarter of a loaf of bread. Worthless. Worthless. Have you ever seen one of these? 1 quintillion, 72 trillion, 416 billion, and $3 million only. there's not a calculator on the planet that can handle that, is it? I mean, how do you even calculate this sort of things? How do you do the exchange rate? Do you know how many people have had everything stolen from them? At one time in Zimbabwe, when they changed the currency, the people in the cities rushed out the countryside and bought a whole lot of land and things like that for countryside people who were excited at the amount of money, but they didn't know that money is now expired. And, I mean, theft like that, some people became billionaires in Zimbabwe. I mean, genuine billionaires. And other people just lost everything. Everything. Now, John, what are the people doing queuing up here outside Barclays Bank?
Trying to get their money.
And how much money will they give them?
Depends on what the bank wants. If they're lucky, the bank might give them $20
a day.
Yeah.
And you've got to queue every day, and that's not enough for you to do anything. So this is the kind of worthless. Now, when you hear about filthy lucre, Paul talks about filthy lucre. This is it. This is filthy lucre. You don't want to know how many hands have handled this in Zimbabwe. And, because they circulate into American dollars over and over and over. This month's special, no fuel. Cue here. Biblical law requires that we use honest scales and honest weights, honest money backed by real constant value. Shall I count pure those with wicked balances, with a bag of deceitful weights? Her rich men are full of violence, her inhabitants have spoken lies, their tongue is deceitful in their mouth. God hates theft, and he hates the theft from moneylenders the most. Remember, what's the one time our Lord Jesus really got angry on earth? He goes in the temple, he makes a whip, and he chases these corrupt Jewish moneylenders out of the temple. So, as somebody posted around Easter, whip a Jewish banker. It's what Jesus would do. Again, this is the standard of justice. Truth is now called hate speech. Why? Because during a time of universal deceit, telling the truth becomes a revolutionary act. Have I become your enemy, says the Apostle Paul, because I've told you the truth? J.C. Ryle said, trials are intended to make us think, wean us from the world, send us to the Bible and drive us to our knees. When we've got problems, economic problems, water problems, all these problems, make us think, what caused this? Why? And if it drives us to the Bible and brings us to our knees and pray to the Lord, then that trial has done some good. Okay, we've got a good country and lovely farms, and they're now endangered. Because if the government can take a farm, they can take any property. Private ownership property and a Bill of Rights means nothing if they can get that right. Now, I don't know if you noticed, but there was an article a while ago in the Mercury, that's a paper in Natal, where they were told that the previously disadvantaged said it's not too late for the previously advantaged whites, Indians, and coloured to apologise for apartheid. So this is what was written back by some clever characters. To the previously disadvantaged, we are sorry that our ancestors were intelligent, advanced, and daring enough to explore the wild oceans, to discover new countries and develop them. We are sorry that those who came before us took you out of the bush and taught you there was more to life than beating drums, killing each other, and chasing animals with sticks and stones. And this is one of the ways how they showed love. This is within sight of where Piet Retief and his 100 followers were murdered after signing a peace treaty with Dingaan, and the church that opened in the shape of Zulu horns, opened up a school for the blind, school for the deaf, an evangelist training school, all on the site of Dingaanstad. We are sorry that they planned, funded, and developed roads, towns, mines, factories, airports, and harbors, all of which you now claim to be a long-deprived inheritance, giving you every right to change and rename these at your discretion. We are sorry that our parents taught us the value of small but strong families, to not breed like rabbits and end up as underfed, diseased, illiterate shack dwellers living in poverty. We're sorry that when the evil apartheid government provided you with schools, you decided they'd look better without windows or in piles of ashes. We happily gave up those bad days of getting spanked, we got caned, in the white schools for doing something wrong. We much prefer these days of freedom, where our problems can be resolved with knives and guns. We are sorry that it's as hard to shake off the bitterness of the past when you keep on raping, torturing, and killing our friends and family members, and then hide behind the French of human rights with smiles on their faces. "We're sorry we do not trust the government. We have no reason to be suspicious because none of these poor hard-working intellectuals have ever been involved in any form of corruption or irregularities. We are sorry we do not trust the police force, and even though they have openly admitted they have lost the war against crime and criminals, we should not be negative. Just ignore the corruption, carry on hoping for the best. We are sorry that it's more important for you to have players of color in our national teams than winning games and promoting patriotism. We know that sponsorship doesn't depend on team success. We're sorry that a border post has been flung open and now left you competing for jobs against illegal immigrants from our beautiful neighboring countries. All of them countries that have grown into economic powerhouses after kicking out the settlers. We're sorry that we don't believe in witchcraft, beetroot and garlic cures, urinating on street corners, virginity testing, slaughtering of bulls in our backyards, trading women for cattle, and other barbaric practices. Maybe we just grew up differently. We're sorry that your medical care, water supplies, roads, railways, and electricity supplies are going down the toilet. Because skilled people who could have planned for and resolved these issues have had to be thrown away because they were of the wrong ethnic background, and now have to work in foreign countries where their skills are highly appreciated. We're so sorry that we'd like this country to fulfill its potential so that we can once again be proud South Africans from the previously advantaged." That's the quote. The myth, the reality. With a box of matches, we shall liberate this country. You've heard of the beer belly. This is now the BEE belly. And Black Economic Empowerment, Affirmative Action. And that is our Minister of Finance playing a video game in Parliament. Yep. If you wondered why the economy is doing so well. Welcome to the South African Parliament. A nation of sheep breeds a government of wolves. As Margaret Thatcher said, the problem with socialism is sooner or later you run out of other people's money. And, yep, isn't it nice being liberated? Even Desmond Tutu, who worked for this, says the ANC's government is worse than apartheid. Even Julius Malema said it was better under apartheid. Not that he'd know, because he never lived under it, but anyway. And yes, thanks to the ANC, we can see the city that was called by the British the richest piece of real estate on earth, literally built on gold, being maintained by the ANC. Now, I'm not going to let you know which pictures were taken in old South Africa and which pictures were taken in the new South Africa, but maybe you can guess which were the days of oppression and which are the days of freedom and liberation. And, yep, Durban Beachfront, the Golden Mile. And why would tourists not want to spend their fortune and come over here? This is great. And by the way, every single time they have these celebrations at the beach, there are at least a dozen drownings washed up. And sometimes they're pleading in the newspapers for weeks afterwards for the relatives to come and claim their child or whatever that drowned. And apparently they don't think it's that important. Yep. Why would you object to this? Port St. John's, by the way, that's in the old Transcar now, Eastern Cape. I want everything for free now, I'll burn everything. Yep, I mean, that's just like, this is UCT, this is Cape Town. And fees have fallen. Yeah, and, okay, what's the worst period in South African history? In the Anglo-Zulu War, about 6,700 were killed. That was a bad war. Isandlwana, Rooksdrift, Ulundi. The Anglo-Boer War, at least 100,000 killed. Mostly women and children, mind you. Under apartheid, 21,000 killed, of which the vast majority of those 14,700 were killed by the ANC, fighting in Inkatha, after Mandela was released from 1990. Under ANC rule, well, in fact, they put in 328,000 there, but that's a very, very conservative figure. So Hendrik Verwoerd could be saying, thank you, ANC, for proving apartheid right every day, 50 times a day. Somebody, Martin Warburg, brought up this book, Is South Africa Too Dumb for Democracy? And how entitlement transcends enlightenment. The entitlement mentality does destroy democracy. Is South Africa too dumb for democracy? Well, the ANC are, That's for sure. Four reasons why affirmative action is bad for business. Yep, that's the Obamas and the Zoomers. But you could put other examples up there. I haven't seen this book yet, but I like the cover, The Lie of Apartheid. Because just about everything I've heard about apartheid since 1994 has been a lie. Here's an interesting point. Between 1962 and 72, the United Nations paid up $298 million, almost $300 million, to underdeveloped countries in Africa. At the same time, South Africa spent almost double that amount, $558 million, on the development of traditional homeland South Africa. So when they speak about, this is apartheid in reverse. No, this is not apartheid in reverse. If the ANC was giving us apartheid in reverse, they would give us our own land, they would buy and build for us hospitals, schools, rugby stadiums, soccer stadiums. They would be giving us vast amounts of money for us to do free electricity, free plumbing, free water and all that sort of thing. That would be reverse apartheid. And then not allowing any people of other races to settle or have businesses in your areas. That would be reverse apartheid. Murdering, torturing, slandering, that's not reverse apartheid. Apartheid never did that. I remember from the youngest hearing, and I especially remember P.W. Botha's speeches, treat people of other races with dignity, with respect, be polite, be thoughtful, be kind, be generous, you know, be good neighbors. And I mean, there was none of this kill the causer kind of song. No. So reverse apartheid's rubbish. What a lie. Apartheid was never as malicious and evil as this socialist regime of the ANC is. The ANC deliberately destroyed 10 different nations in this country's independence, including Maputo, Tswana, Venda, Siska, and many others. Now, here's some shocker. The ANC duped us to get votes. You think? Wow. Corruption. More corruption. This is the point. The land invasions is distraction. It's a smokescreen for corruption. Now, this is just an early report. Zuma said corruption hurts nobody. It's only white people concerned about corruption. Okay. So, let's just take what you could do with $675 billion. But by the way, 25% of the total wealth of Africa is stolen every single year, according to African Union, by corruption, by governments alone. So the biggest theft of all is done by governments. A quarter of the gross domestic product of Africa on average. Our national income or gross GDP is $4 trillion a year. At least $1 trillion that's stolen by the government. Okay, now, here we're just talking about $675 billion. This is before the World Cup. This is quite a while ago. So, what could that do? Well, it could have built 4 million more houses for just $216 billion. They could have provided for another 1,000 schools with $25 billion. They could have hosted 10 World Cups for another $50 billion. $375 billion could have built 10 new hospitals around them for 18 years, and you could just carry on. This is what you could do with the money stolen by corruption, by the Guptas, the Zumas, and all the others. This is $1,000. This is $10,000. This is $1 million. This is $100 million. This is $1 billion. This is $1 trillion. Every year, this government steals more than $1 trillion through government corruption, according to African Union stats. A trillion rand a year is stolen by government every year in this country. That's the person. There's a pallet. You guys have packed a pallet around here? So, in fact, there's a double pallet. See, those are double stack pallets. There's one pallet. Those are double stack pallets. Give you another idea. That's an airfield. That's a football field. That's an aircraft. And just think how much is stolen from this country. I remember when 5 rand filled the tank. Genuine. My first mission, I drove from Cape Town to Johannesburg and it cost 34 rand fuel. From Cape Town to Johannesburg, 1,400 kilometers. You filled up a tank with 5 rand. Genuine. That's at the beginning of this mission. Today, 100 rand, and it's still on the E. Yep, that's the difference between Van Riebeek and Mandela. Restore the rule of law. This is why we've produced biblical principles for Africa. It's a proven fact that criminals commit less crime after they've been shot. So what can we do? What can we do to stop the farm invasions and the murders? Just to remind you of what this country was like. Here's Lady Anne Barnard's watercolors and sketches. Okay? This is what 220 years ago, Lady Anne Barnard came out to the Cape. She is the wife of the colonial secretary, and she traveled all around the Western Cape. Phenomenal amount of activity. And her sketches give us an idea of what the Cape was like. And one of the things that Lady Anne Barnard communicated was the Cape was arid. In 1797, when she arrived, very, very little trees. Very few trees. I mean, you get a bit of a feel of this as well. Okay, they've been planting a few trees there. But the Cape, in her days, very few trees on the hillsides. You can see very little on Devil's Peak there. They tried to plant a few, but this is pretty arid. Not much there. Very little rainfall as well. And so the British went berserk planting trees. They planted millions of trees because there wasn't that much rain. And in fact, the problem that they found was that they built a road at great expense to Stellenbosch, which disappeared in 1 year under sea sand. A road to Stellenbosch disappeared under sea sand. And so they started to build vast amounts of trees. They planted trees all over. And remember we took you over to see during the Great Commission course, see the Paradise, which was one of their locations. But notice how little trees there were on the hillsides. And all the trees that were around were what the colonials planted. Okay, now giving you just a bit of a feel for this, because this, by the way, was not what they found. They built this. So they didn't steal it from some Hottentot. And this is what you see from the Vineyard Hotel today. We need to understand our history. And that's why Sketches from South African History is written. We have to know history. People can guilt manipulate you into giving away everything, the farm even. Your ancestors did not steal this country. They built it. And now you've got a bunch of people marching like this who want to steal everything. And, now you've got people who are... Yeah, the Peter McCarver Stadium. He's the one who started the Kill the Boer, Kill the Farmer song. And now they're wanting to rename one of the stadiums up there after this murderer. So, silent genocide. These are protests overseas. This is in Britain. See the Mandela statue? This is outside the British Parliament. People are protesting in the name of South Africa in... That would be in the Netherlands, I think. Standing with us, and some of you may remember Black Monday, 30th of October last year.
Was it not Black Friday?
It was Black Monday, 30th. We would have been there if it had been a Friday, but sadly Monday and Tuesday we were committed to Frontruck, of course. We had the Back to the Bible conference. So these are the protests. Don't milk our future dry. No farmers, no future. So these are some different protests and prayers, and notice what's the response of this character, this minister. We strongly condemn the racism on display at the Black Monday protest. What about the murders of 4,000 farmers? Can't they get the point? They're concerned that somebody might have had a flag that represents another opinion. Like, so what? What's more important? You hurt my feelings? Or you murdered my grandmother. I mean, honestly, let's get this in some kind of perspective. Interesting how some people are turning the beach towel into a Christian symbol type flag. How do you stop genocide? They say you've got the right to life in our constitution, but it's the criminal who has the right to life. The victims don't have a right to life. And the babies in the womb don't have a right to life. Now, I want to show you something seriously important. The black line indicates attacks, the number of attacks. The red, numbers of farmers murdered. it would appear from our investigations that out of every 6 attacks, 5 fail. Assuming that only one farmer or family member dies in an attack where there's a farm murder, it means that when the farmers are attacked, even though the attackers outnumber them and have the element of surprise, on more cases than not, the farmer turns the tables, successfully defends, and the attackers are either killed, wounded, arrested, or flee, unsuccessful. So while we want to emphasize the importance of the case against genocide, bear in mind the farmers are not just helpless victims waiting to be murdered. Most farmers are alert, and so alert that you can see here what was happening. You could see it was increasing, but then the people must have got more alert and were able to make good measures. But in the year 2000, there was, what happened here? Why is this a sudden spike? Thabo Mbeki became president. He started the Firearm Control Act 2000, and they bamboozled a lot of people to handing in their weapons, and there was a decrease of people having weapons, and you suddenly had this massive spike in murders. But again, as the Constitutional Court then decreed by about this time, no, it's unconstitutional. The Firearm Control Act 2000 is unconstitutional. Your old green licenses are still valid and so on and so forth. Suddenly, it looks like the farmer attacks, not that the farmer attacks dropped off too much, but the murders dropped off for sure. And then you see a great increase in tax, but 2007, no increase in the numbers of people murdered. We marched to Parliament and protested in the name of Victims Against Crime, one of our initiatives, against, as this person said, stupid draconian gun bill. That the only reason you'd want gun control is if your goal is genocide. A gun in the hand is worth more than the entire police force on the phone. As was shown in the London attacks, when the police were very proud to say that within 4 minutes of receiving the phone call, they were on the scene, and within 6 minutes, all the terrorists had been neutralized. Yeah, but in that time, that killed how many people? So when seconds count, the police are minutes away. And that's best case scenario. That's a London police, central London, who've got a phenomenal response time. But they didn't get them time to save a whole lot of lives. A gun in the hand is worth a whole lot of police on the phone. So be armed, be prepared. And Lenin thought imperialism was the highest stage of capitalism. But in South Africa, barbarism is the highest stage of imperialism. We had the Anglo-Boer War, when the savage British imperialists sought to destroy this country, and only Boers with guns made a stand and nearly derailed them. We've had commandos over the years, and the commando system kept the farmers safe for 300 years. It started out totally and completely private, independent. Sadly, in the 1960s, we allowed the government to take control. We thought we could trust the government. But the trouble is the commando system got totally controlled by the government, and they provided the weapons, whereas in the past, the commando provided their own weapons. And we got to the point where Thabo Mbeki said, we're closing down the commandos and taking back the weapons. This has led to the attacks on the farms. Since Thabo Mbeki dismantled our commando system, we need to be armed, we need to be trained, we need to be prepared. I don't know where you can get one of these, but this looks like a good idea. The example of Switzerland. Switzerland doesn't have an army. Switzerland is an army. And just a friendly reminder, we have our own war veterans, 600,000 of them, and ours actually did fight a war, and we won against the Russians and Cubans, mind you. So if these malemas want something like a war, Peter Kronewald in Parliament said, I've forgotten more about war than all of you have ever learned. Which is a good warning. The book that we've just produced, Security and Survival, launched in January, is timely. We need our people to be very alert for security and survival. We need to do training. We need to get the shooting range. We need to be networked. We need to know our neighbors. We've got to be prepared for water shortages. I think we've got to be prepared for electricity power failure outs. These people who think that, oh, we're okay because we've got an electric fence around the top of our wall. Well, that's not much good if there's a power failure, is it? And if you're in a gated community, that's great, isn't it? But the people at the gates could be members of the EFF. Open the gates, say, please come in. I mean, those things are not secure enough. Who will rise up for me against the evildoers? Who will make a stand for me against the workers of iniquity? And this is a time for us to stand up. We've got to know our history. We must be alert. We've got to be informed. You can see we've started a whole lot of different new Facebook pages. In addition to Reformation 500, we've got the Henry Morton Stanley School of Christian Journalism. We've got Young Reformers Who Change the World and others that are tackling tough subjects. So let's understand the biblical principles. I've put on the table the case for Cape Independence, some of the material against Marxism, because that's what we're dealing with. The Agenda 2 DVD is very helpful. Remember what they said? The issue is never the issue. The issue is the revolution. Governments are the biggest threat to life. And we need to inform our people about communism, about our history, about our idols, and do everything we can to dismantle the propaganda industry, which is whipping up people to be willing to do the kind of atrocities. But if these EFF and ANC cadres, these cannon fodder on the ground, could realize they're just being used by dupes. The biggest thieves are the government and the banks who are doing the inflation, taxation, and corruption. If they would realize how much has been stolen by them, no wonder they want to have a scapegoat, blame the poor farmer, who's actually doing something good for everyone. He's feeding everyone. He's giving employment. The real thieves are actually the crooks in government and the banks. If they could see that and redirect their frustrations, that could make a big difference. So I think that's a lot of the battle. We've got to reclaim the campuses. This is where a lot of the battle is.